Hey, we're back. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and creative entrepreneurs looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. Welcome to episode 153, Adventure is Calling, with Lucy Bellwood. In this episode, I'm going to talk about adventure and how it shows up as a physical search for new experiences in my life, as well as the role it plays as curiosity in the work that I do. In the spirit of adventure, this week's Getting Work to Work interview is with Lucy Bellwood, an adventure cartoonist combining her love of ships and the open sea with comics. Her latest project, 100 Demon Dialogues, I dare say, is an internal adventure bringing to light the inner demons that plague our life and creative work. And they often say to us things like, you're no good. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/153. When I see the distant mountains, adventure beckons like the whispers of a long-lost friend. It's that time of the year for me when the seasons change, you can smell adventure in the air, and it's really exciting because every morning I take my wife to work, I drive on the bridge that goes over the Columbia River, I can see Mount Hood in the distance, I see the Columbia River Gorge beckoning me, and adventure is calling. As a child, I loved reading atlases. I loved to look at maps. There was something about getting beyond my daily life and going on an adventure. As an adult, I love reading Atlas Obscura when I go to bed at night. It's a book of places around the world that are just interesting. Movies such as The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and Indiana Jones both call to me and say, hey, you want to go on these adventures. It's funny because I was thinking about when I was younger, I went on a trip to Israel, and I remember walking around all of these different ruins, listening to Dream Theater, listening to prog rock, listening to metal. And there's a connection with the music that I listen to. It's taking me on these journeys. I'm going on adventures. Really, this episode is all about adventure because I don't know about you, but I could really use an adventure right now, both literally and creatively. A lot of the things that I'm going to talk about in this episode are literal journeys, their experiences, and they're just one part of how adventure is calling me. It could be things like going to new places or trying new foods, or in the case of my work, trying new techniques. And it's really about pushing myself into new directions and wrestling with new ideas. Because when I'm adventurous, I find that my work is more creative and interesting. And conversely, when I feel that my work is stale or it's tired, it's because there's a general lack of adventure in my life. And so in this episode, I'm going to share 10 ways that I'm looking to incorporate adventure into not only my life, but also my work. First, I acknowledge the call of adventure when I hear it. It's like this morning when I can see the blue sky, when I can see the mountain off in the distance, I hear the call. I hear you, adventure. I'm going to do something about it. I may not be able to go on a full-scale adventure around the world, but I hear the call, and I'm going to respond in whatever scale that I can at this time. Maybe it's just getting out and going for a walk. Maybe it's going for a small hike. Maybe it's going home a new direction. Maybe it's finally playing with Envision Studio. All of these things might seem small, but it's saying, hey, I'm not ignoring you, adventure. Keep on reaching out to me. Keep on saying, hey, I know you want to go on this adventure. Go for it. Second, I plan for time to explore in my daily schedule. It seems funny to have to schedule time to do something, but if I don't put something in my calendar, chances are I'm not really going to do it. And so if adventure is important to me, I desperately need to schedule it. For me, scheduling is generally in four areas. It's people, places, work, and ideas. In order to explore in terms of people, that's meeting up for friends for coffee. It's maybe going to meetups. It's being exposed to people that I may or may not be exposed to on a daily basis. When it comes to places, it's maybe trying a new place for coffee, a new place for lunch, or maybe going to a new bookstore, things like that. When it comes to work, generally, a lot of my work is defined by the content production schedule. So I'm producing two podcasts now, and they both have weekly release dates. So how can I schedule time to explore new ideas? Maybe it's new vocal techniques. Maybe it's new video ideas. If I don't schedule it, I'm not going to explore it. And that's the same with ideas. If I'm not reading new books, if I'm not writing in my notebook every day, I'm going to miss out on something and I might ignore the call of adventure. Third, I ask for recommendations from others. Oftentimes when I'm in a class teaching students, they often want to know, how do you get started doing this? Or how do I find people that are doing that? And the answer to those questions always is, I ask someone what they do. I love getting recommendations for restaurants, recommendations for vacation spots. When people share what they're passionate about, it's a great way to connect with them. And it's a great way to get in touch with adventure at a larger scale beyond just myself. Fourth, I pay attention to what I'm dreaming about. What is my subconscious telling me to do? Dreams can be really strange. For example, I've been dreaming a lot about fences lately, and oddly enough, it's because the fence fell down in my backyard and I've had some anxiety about getting it fixed. But what's interesting is, like, on one hand, I can hear the anxiety of the fence telling me, fix me. But on the other hand, it's the adventure of knowing that I don't know how to actually fix a fence. I mean, conceptually, I know that you need to dig out the old fence posts, concrete, and put in new ones. But I've never done it before, so there's some anxiety there. But that's an adventure. Why don't I do that? I need to pay attention to those things because those are really awesome adventures that I could go on if I'm willing to do it, if I will heed the call of adventure. Fifth, I do the things I know that fill me with life and creativity. I know there are certain things that I love to do, and sometimes I just don't do them. I know that I just love nature. I love going on backpacking trips. I love hiking. And sometimes I just don't give myself the time to do them. I fill my days with work from when I wake up to when I go to sleep. But if I don't do those things that fill me with life, my creativity dies. My sense of adventure fades. And so I just need to do those things. Sixth, I embrace daily variety. As much as I need structure in my days, I also need variety. How about you? I know for a lot of creative people, we need variety. We need a variety of tasks. We need a variety of locations and a variety of people. And so for me, I'm really trying to embrace this sense of daily variety. Whether it's, you know, new lunchtimes, new places to go. I keep touching on the importance of variety and adventure. But for me, it's really embracing it and accepting it and being okay with the fact that I need structure in some areas, but a lot of variety in others. Because what happens is when I don't create variety, when I don't embrace variety, I get bored. I get tired. I end up fighting the resistance, which leads me to seventh. I need to fight the resistance and get my work done so that I can play. In his book, The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield writes a lot about this idea of the resistance, the thing that holds us back from doing our best work. And for me, resistance is often things like boredom, lack of variety, all I do is work and no play. What holds me back oftentimes is that resistance and being like, oh, I'm so bored. I'm anticipating when I'm editing this podcast, I'm going to feel that resistance weighing down on me, even though it's been a while since I've done this podcast, so I have energy around getting it done. But I have to fight that resistance and get this work done so that I can then play. See how that works? For me, I haven't played though. All I've done is worked. I think adventure really comes down to this idea of play, whether it's work, life, or whatever. Eighth, I must go down the unknown path even when I'm afraid. I've made some massive changes to my life this year, taking on a new job. That's an unknown path. I'm used to working by myself, and now I'm working with 25 other people. It's scary. The other night I went to the Sons of Apollo concert in Portland. It got out at like 11:30 at night. It's dark. I'm walking down a street in Portland by myself, and I'm afraid. But then I turned the corner to where my car was parked, and it's even pitch black, and I'm just frightened. There's no streetlights. It's a residential area, and I'm freaking out. But in my head, I'm like, I gotta go down the unknown path. My heart starts beating. I'm walking fast. In my head, I'm like, I hope I don't get mugged. But that's an adventure. Even though I'm afraid, I'm going down this path going, wow, the other day I wasn't doing this. I was sitting at my desk working, whereas tonight, I'm looking left, I'm looking right in a pitch black environment going, am I going to get out of this? Am I going to make it to the car? What's going to happen? That's adventure. Ninth, I have to keep learning and desire to have a beginner's attitude. I love learning new things. I love reading books. I love taking courses, but that's not enough. Have you ever seen a beginner do something and their eyes just light up and they get excited, they get full of a drive to keep on learning? That's what I want. That's what adventure is for me. It's the gleam of passion in the eyes of the beginner. Recently, I've been teaching my wife how to code, and there's that passion there in her eyes. It's the beginner's attitude. It's all things are possible. This is amazing. That is what incorporating adventure into my life and work look like. 10th, and finally, and this one's incredibly important, I need to seek to increase the size of my dreams and what I think is possible for my life and work. If all I think is possible is what I know that I can do, I'm not going to go on many adventures and I'm going to actually get bored and burn out. That's going to make adventure extremely hard. So I need to constantly be increasing the size of what is actually possible. So before we get to the interview with Lucy Bellwood, I want to leave you with a few questions to ponder. What role does adventure play in your life and work? Do you have enough adventure in your life and work, or are you burnt out? How are you going to answer the call of adventure? I hope this monologue about adventure has been helpful for you. I've really enjoyed thinking about it, talking about it. And now here's the interview with Lucy Bellwood, adventure cartoonist, and all of the things that she does in her work and life that bring out her sense of adventure. Lucy, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little about what you do?
Absolutely. So I am, I bill myself as a professional adventure cartoonist, which is a job title that I arrived at through a very circuitous route. And honestly, one that with the debut of my newest book, I question the utility of continuing to adhere to, but I also just got into it. So it's like, why, by the time you figure out something that works, you kind of have to change your whole setup. And that's a great metaphor for being a freelancer in general. Anytime you get something figured out, the whole game changes. But I have done two graphic novels now and a host of small mini comics. Most of them are autobiographical. I specialize in work that is about going out into the world and exploring things and learning about them and then distilling that information into graphic form. So I've done a couple comics about whitewater rafting excursions in the Grand Canyon and trips aboard various replica and modern tall ships, sailing vessels from modeled on ships of the 18th century. And that was my background before I got into making comics. When I was in high school, I got into tall ship sailing and became a deckhand on a ship called the Lady Washington, who sails up and down the West Coast, teaching kids and the public about maritime history. And it was kind of a lifelong dream, I would say, to go back in time and be a part of this lifestyle that I didn't know was possible. And it turns out it's totally still a thing you can do. So my first book, Baggy Wrinkles, A Lubber's Guide to Life at Sea, is all a collection of short stories about my time working on tall ships, how one could go and do that for themselves if they were interested in doing it, and so on and so forth. And my newest project is called 100 Demon Dialogues. It's just been going out to Kickstarter backers over the last month. It was funded last year in the summer, and it's the culmination of the 100-day project. And I think it's nice that we're recording this week, because the 100-day project for 2018 just started.
Nice.
And I'm not participating this year, so the least I can do is talk about it and lament that I'm not participating in it. I did it 2 years running, and I really needed a break this year because I'm still wrapping up production on this project that was my last 100-day project in 2017. But 100 Demon Dialogues is a collection of short single-panel comics. They were drawn 100 of them over 100 consecutive days, and they are about learning to live with imposter syndrome and anxiety and grappling with our inner critics in a way that accounts for the fact that they are a part of us and will never really go away, as opposed to this mentality of, like, if you're successful, that must mean that you just don't experience self-doubt or anxiety ever, which must be nice. But yeah, exactly. I certainly haven't reached that nirvana yet.
Nice. So when did you know you wanted to be an adventure cartoonist?
Last week? I don't know. Well, I grew up in a very outdoorsy environment. I went to schools that had encouraged a lot of robust outdoor education enthusiasm in me. And I grew up in a sort of semi-rural valley in Southern California that was really, there were a lot of opportunities to be outside and interacting with nature and exploring the world. And I come from a family of bookworms, and so I was also an avid reader as a child. And my mother was a cartoonist briefly before I was born. She's always been a creative person. Both my parents are writers. And the more I get into this career, I think the harder it is to say, oh, I took a class in college in adventure cartooning and then decided I wanted to do that also. Like, there's no roadmap for this career. But also, when I look back, all of the factors that led into me being where I am now make a lot of sense. Mm. So I was kind of thick. I didn't realize that you could draw words and write pictures. Yeah, that's right. until I was probably in, I would say, high school. Maybe I started getting really into webcomics in junior high, mm-hmm. and seeing creators like Danielle Corsetto and Dylan McConis and Erica Moen making autobiographical and fictional comics and putting them on the internet and not needing to wait for permission from established gatekeepers and creators was like, wow, I could do this. Not just I could consume this media. I enjoy consuming this media, but like I could make this. And certainly coming of age at a time when the internet was becoming more and more of a thing was a really noticeable and interesting experience, because like learning about stuff on DeviantArt, on Elfwood, like all these old artistic communities online where I was seeing people making stuff and sharing it and like getting connected to all these folks who I did not have access to growing up in a town of 9,000-10,000 people.
Yeah.
So it was, a lot of it came about because of the internet. And then a lot of it came about because of trial and error, honestly, like making comics and then thinking like, oh, I don't want to just sit at a desk and make comics. I want to make comics in the field. I want to do stuff. And, you know, at that point, I mean, Joe Sacco was kind of on my radar when I was in college, but like comics journalism was not the thing that it has become now. I think arguably it's really blossomed in the last few years. And that's in no small part due to publications like Symbolia Magazine and The Nib and like places that are really pushing doing rapid fire comics journalism, as opposed to like a Joe Sacco book could take years to produce because they're so gorgeous and labor intensive. And like, that's a particular kind of reportage that's still deeply important. But I think for sort of rapid fire, you know, speedy stuff, it's also cool that we're getting publications that are focusing more on that. So anyway, that's kind of a rambly answer, but I didn't really put two and two together and say, oh, adventure cartoonist, that's the right word for what I do, until probably the beginning of last year. I was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean working on an oceanographic research vessel and making comics about bathymetry through a bizarre series of circumstances that had brought me there. And we were on our way to Hawaii. And that was the moment where it all kind of came together. I had called myself a cartoonist who goes on adventures previously, but that is sort of a mouthful. And I used to say tall ship sailing cartoonist, and that didn't really make a lot of sense either. I mean, it makes sense, but it's trial and error until you find the term that when you say it, people go, wow, I don't even know what that is, but I want it. I'd never heard of an adventure cartoonist before today, but now I think it's the coolest job ever. That was when I knew that I'd hit on something that made sense for encompassing what I do. You don't have to know the official job description of being an adventure cartoonist because it's right there in the name. I go on adventures, I make cartoons about going on adventures. Like, it's pretty easy. The reason I say I'm doubting all of that is that the new book is not about external adventures. It is about internal adventures. Ooh. Adventures of the human soul.
Yes. Sign me up. I'm there.
Awesome. Great. Okay. I'll just keep selling it like that. But it's definitely a bit of a departure. I was building up this body of work that was like, yeah, I can call it, yeah, adventure cartoonist. This all kind of fits together. And now I have this book that I'm like, everyone who was there for my first book is like, yeah, great. So are there boats in this one? And I'm like, no.
Boats over the river Styx of your soul?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pay boatmen to read these comics about your soul. I'm the boatman. yeah, it's a whole different thing. So that's I'm awesome. Kind of feeling that out right now as I start pitching the book to broader outlets and selling it at conventions. And it's definitely having it debut at Emerald City Comic Con was really interesting because I have this table that's very nautically themed. It's like covered in plastic sea creatures and there's, you know, prints and stuff and this and that. And then this whole section of demon books that I kind of have to like explain is a different ghetto of creative practice. So we'll see how that unfolds. Watch this space.
You mentioned permission earlier, and I'm curious what type of permission you needed in order to finally say, I'm an adventure cartoonist, or I'm even a cartoonist, to go back. I mean, what type of permission did you need?
That's such a good question. There's a couple things. Validation of peer group, you know, being able to commune regularly in person with other folks who were making comics. Mm. And as being a part of that community, feeling able to lay claim to a title of saying, yeah, I make comics, I'm a cartoonist. So there was that. When I was in college, I started a weekly drawing group that met at my house that was open door every Thursday night. People would come over and bring snacks and we would hang out and draw comics and talk shop. And it was a really welcoming, inclusive space. And I really enjoyed running it for the 3 years, I think, that I ran it. I passed it off to a friend of mine who now continues the tradition in Portland.
That's cool.
But that was really vital for me. I desperately wanted like a group of people to spend time with in person. And I went to a small liberal arts college here in Portland that doesn't have a robust arts department. It's very small. The school in general is very small, the arts department even more so. So it was really a mix of people there, many of whom were working in sculpture or digital media or, you know, other stuff. It wasn't like a whole department of comics people. And increasingly there are educational programs where you can get that, which is amazing. The thing that really kicked me into making comics was going to the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, Vermont for a summer class. It was like a 5-day intensive cartooning studio.
That's cool.
Thing. And that was where I drew my first mini comic. And I would say that I wasn't comfortable calling myself a cartoonist after that, but I knew that that was what I wanted to be after that point.
That's cool.
So there was that kind of hurdle of finding a community and building a communal identity with other people around that practice. And then I think one of the really big things was my very first Kickstarter campaign. I've run 3 to date, and I did it when I was in college. It was the last sort of creative act of my undergraduate career to publish the comic that I'd drawn for my senior thesis project. And the campaign was really moving to me for a number of reasons. It was very successful, more so than I had anticipated. Hmm. And I was trying to raise $1,200, which to me felt like an astronomical sum of money. I do not come from a moneyed family. And so it was like, wow, this is so much money. Like Kickstarter was newer back then. I didn't really understand how it worked. And the campaign funded in hours, you know, and then like continued to skyrocket over the remaining 3 weeks. And it was really incredible. But that act of a group of people, community of people, especially people who don't know you super well, you know, because like your friends, your family, sure, but like your acquaintances, mm-hmm. people that you've met social dancing, or like folks you shared a class with once your freshman year, those kinds of people stepping up and giving you their hard-earned cash and saying, I value this thing that you're doing, not just with compliments, but with my dollars. That's the most potent form of permission I think I have experienced yet, to say, we believe in what you're doing. Here is some money to go into it. And it's the reason that if I meet with younger cartoonists and, you know, they're saying, oh, can you take a look at the zine that I made, or could you look at my first mini comic? I will always offer them money to buy it, because I think that's the biggest light bulb moment for a lot of people, is this is worth something. I am worth something.
Wow. That's awesome. Wow. That just kind of hit me hard. Wow. That's what an empowering feeling to that content creator to say that what you're doing is valuable.
Yes, absolutely. And it doesn't take a lot, you know, like giving somebody a $5 bill or like a $3 bunch of ones. There's no $3 bill, but
yes,
giving somebody $3, you know, giving them a $5 bill. Like, it doesn't have to cost a lot to tell somebody that you value their contribution to a creative field. And that impression can last for a really long time. So I think it's something to always keep in mind when you're attending conventions, or, you know, talking with people who are just starting out, or seeing creators who are plugging their work online. And I think it's more potent if you are talking to somebody in person and you hand them the money and you're like, me, a human being, is giving you money for this.
Yeah.
But even on the internet, it's still valuable when you see people starting out to say, yeah, I'll chuck $3 into that. You know, yeah, I'll pay $5 to help support you start this thing that you're trying to get off the ground, because it's an investment, you know, and the internet allows us to follow people as they grow over time from that investment.
So moving from getting into cartooning and being an adventure cartoonist to being, you know, a freelancer and doing this work for others, what systems have you put in place to help build a career that can be sustainable?
I put this on my list of questions that I wanted to talk about, mostly because I don't have any glib answers to it. I'm trying to figure this out. This is definitely
good.
I mark 2010 as the year that I got into this. So like, I'm 8 years in, and nice. I mean, you know, 7.5, but who's counting? My benchmark for myself is that 10 years is kind of about how long it takes to build a sustainable, thriving career in a new field. So I am keeping in mind that I'm a couple years out from not being in a place where I'm done, you know, and I'm just going to like coast on savings until retirement or whatever, but that I am in a place where I have a roadmap for what my work is. I feel established in my field. I have, you know, a degree of professional respect to be able to command jobs that I'm interested in. And I see myself on track to that in some ways. And then the ways that I feel I'm not quite on track to it yet are systems. And it's really interesting that you use that word, systems, instead of, you know, what are your like productivity hacks or whatever. It's like, there's no shortcut for this. And yeah. I was just talking to someone yesterday about how it's really difficult for me to put time and effort into developing systems that will pay off down the line, as opposed to to-do list items that I could knock off right now. Like, there are 3 packages I need to take to the post office. I want to take those packages to the post office, because then I can say, I took the packages to the post office. I'm done, done for the day. But what I want is to set up a database that will tell me when someone new reaches out over the internet and asks to see a sample of my work, here's the automatic chain of events that should follow from that. And if I were a company, I would have a division of people whose responsibility it would be to develop those types of workflows and systems, but I don't, because it's just me. And I am working on hiring help. This is the first year that I've really leaned into working with individuals. I have subcontracted to companies before for fulfillment, for Kickstarter, stuff like that. But I get the feeling that this year I'm doing more work individually with other people, freelancers who I'm hiring. Yeah. And especially in those circumstances, I'm recognizing that it's not enough to just have my slapdash, scatterbrain, Evernote, workflowy, Google Doc, behemoth, Hydra, getting in the way of everything. Like, I need something more organized. The systems that I have implemented that I think are very valuable. When I started freelancing, I got an accountant as quickly as possible, because yes. that was something that I knew I was not strong in. And I wanted someone who knew what they were about to help guide me towards an understanding of how my finances worked. And so I found an accountant who I love, and that has been a really helpful system. I think it's taken me many years, but now, you know, probably about four or five years to feel like I'm in a place where I have a system, I understand it, I have tools that work for me, and now I have a spreadsheet that I populate with expenses, and like I am pretty certain, I mean, I still make mistakes, but I at least have places for stuff to go.
Nice.
And that's a big part of it, right? If you're familiar with getting things done, which is, you know, as a sort of productivity philosophy, a big portion of that is having places to put stuff. Like when new information comes in, rather than just letting it pile up in your email inbox, or, you know, putting it on a post-it and putting it in a drawer and forgetting about it. It's like, I know exactly where this goes. It needs to get done 5 weeks from now. So I'm going to put it there and then not think about it until that date comes due. So there are some technological tools that I have found helpful for that. I use Inbox, which is a sort of more streamlined version of Gmail, which I like a great deal. And that has some good snooze capabilities. It's kind of built around a lot of getting things done principles. Yes. And it's a lot cleaner to look at. And mentally, that's very helpful for me. I'm still very bad at replying to email. And it's something I would like to get better at. I just started experimenting with Airtable, which is a sort of database and collaboration management tool, software suite. I don't know. My partner Andy turned me onto it, and I have really only been playing around with it for the last week. I'm already totally overwhelmed. I do not have a head with like numbers and spreadsheets and things, but I see the potential of what it could be. And that's where the challenge is. Am I spinning my wheels doing stuff that feels productive? Like, oh, I really have to tag all these entries in this spreadsheet, you know, by geographic location in order to build a system that's going to work for me in the future. And like, is that actually true? Or am I just doing something that feels productive and is actually busy work? It's hard for me to tell at this point. So building systems is something that I struggle with, but it's something that's on my mind a lot.
And I think it's important for every creative professional to really think about, because we want to build sustainable careers.
We do. And so many people in my circles are reaching this point 8 years in of saying, oh, not only am I established now, I'm a business. You know, so many of us are independent. We're not working with publishers. We're not, or even if we are, so much of that work still falls on our shoulders. And especially with the proliferation of social media and how much value even mainstream publishers place in that, you know, an author with a dedicated online following is just automatically more appealing, because that's an audience. You know, those are people who are going to buy your thing. And the publisher knows, like, oh, this person can throw their weight around on the internet, and they know that people are going to listen, or they're going to pay attention to what goes on there. So it is important to have something that doesn't make that feel like a baton death march of self-promotion, which it does feel like sometimes. Some of those systems are finding people that I trust and being willing to, again, invest money in those people. That's a big one. Okay, something that has made this sustainable is recognizing that not only are other people worth money and worth investing in, or my creative work is worth money, but my well-being, and that includes logistical well-being, is worth money. Mm-hmm. As a DIY self-publisher, I'm very attached to the notion that I can do it all myself. It's like, it's just more efficient to do it all myself. And that is profoundly untrue. There is a certain point where the return on investment is not worth it.
Yes.
And I think it was after I bought a flight to the Toronto Comic Arts Festival on airline points that had me route through Los Angeles and like arrive from PDX at 11 p.m. LAX airport time, spend the night in the airport, and then fly at 3 a.m. from LAX to Toronto, and then arrive and have to go straight to the convention. And I was like, what am I doing? Yes, this flight cost me $6, but also like, I'm a wreck, you know, it's not worth it. So
I'm exhausted just listening to that.
I know, it was awful. So I definitely have reached a point where I am dedicating financial investment, not only to my product, to making good books, to making nice looking mini comics or whatever, but also to working with people who will maybe take a cut of my profits, but it's worth it to me to not ship all of my own store orders, or it's worth it to me to have somebody on deck who I can contact to reach out about publicity to other outlets and help me plan my book tour, or, you know, someone who can ship all my Kickstarter rewards or warehouse my books. Like, all of those things are deeply worth it to me, and I'm becoming more and more comfortable with that. And obviously part of that is made possible by higher income over time, you know, having more books to sell, more things to bring in money. But then that's the dance, is you start making more money and then you start spending more money. And that's, I guess, what becoming an adult means in a capitalist society.
Yeah.
But I'm a fan of the part of it that means that I get more comfortable with taking care of myself and investing in my well-being. So yes. That's maybe another form of permission, actually. Maybe these two questions aren't so distant from one another, is having permission to call yourself a cartoonist and then having permission to say a cartoonist is not synonymous with miserable, overworked hack, and instead is like nourished business owner.
Yeah.
With a valid support network. And there are also, there are like personal discipline systems, like taking days off or understanding what weekends are or setting time aside for exercise. I think those are also really valuable. It's really easy.
Especially if you're going to be a deckhand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. on a tall ship, if you want time to go play around at sea, like that's also important. And just remembering that your internet presence will not die if you leave for a week or 3 weeks or a month or a quarter. Like, I think people actually admire that, or they just forget that you're gone and then you come back and they're happy that you're back.
So what is one struggle that you find yourself consistently battling and having to work through, and how do you do it? Make a comic about demons?
Okay, well, something that, a specter that haunts my career, I think, is that I am, Jessica Hish gave a great interview where she talked about the two types of careers that she has encountered in her work. And there are people who have a single-minded focus on being a certain thing from an early age. They know I'm going to be an accountant. They like go down that road aggressively towards being an accountant. And then there are people who are like, well, I like doing things with numbers and also spreadsheets, but like, I don't know if that's taxes or maybe it's nonprofit budgeting work. Like, and so the first one is very linear. The second one she refers to as Tarzaning, which is the experience of swinging from vine to vine. And as you reach the end of vine number one, you look around and you grab whatever's closest because you can't be picky at that point. And then you swing for the next, you know, vine. And when you get to the end of that swing, you think like, oh, what's near and dear to me right now that looks interesting? And that trajectory is probably going to carry you. Neil Gaiman has that commencement speech where he talks about like your mountain, right? Like always orienting towards your mountain. So maybe that vine swinging is carrying you in the general direction of your mountain, but it's not the most efficient route, and you end up detouring to do a lot of other stuff along the way. And that I related to very strongly the minute she said it, because I've never felt like I have a really clear idea of where I'm going, even though when you look back on it, it's like, yes, this has been a very clear, like this making comics, do the thing, magic cartooning, boats, of course, it all makes sense, but it doesn't make sense while you're living it. And something that continues to haunt me is this notion that I don't have it in me to do a sustained long-term comics project. That's the biggest thing that terrifies me. And I have really found that the system that makes the most sense for me to overcome that is something like the 100 Day Project or Inktober or any kind of drawing challenge that creates structure. Structure is the thing that allows me to relax into my creative process, as opposed to someone saying, just draw whatever you want, man. Like, just total freedom. Total freedom, ironically, even though that is kind of like the backbone of my creative practice and the thing that I love about being self-employed, is hell for me.
Yeah.
I hate having total freedom. I want somebody who knows what they're doing to guide me. You know, I want mentors. I'm like hungry for spaces of learning. And for so many of us coming up in comics right now, there is no roadmap. And there are people who have done something that we would like to replicate, but oftentimes by the time they've done it, the systems that enabled that to happen have already become obsolete, or the game has changed, you know, something new is happening. It is individual to pretty much every creator I know. There are shared successes, shared general principles, but given what makes each person successful, like it's really unique when you're self-employed and running your own business and publishing your own work. I continue to be hungry for that kind of mentorship and structure. And the closest thing I've been able to find that takes some of that anxiety away from me is putting strictures in place that mean that I can prove to myself that I'm capable of accomplishing something like drawing a page of comics every day for 3.5 months straight, and to not worry too much. You know, it's that initial stage where, ironically, that's how you get past the inner critic, is just by producing a lot of work. And you can edit after that, you know, you can prune and fix and adjust. But for that first sprint of producing the body of work, it's really about putting your anxiety on a shelf and saying, like, listen, my job is not to make something good. My job is to make something sustainable. My job is to make something long. That's the biggest fix in heavy quotation marks I've been able to find thus far. And I am curious to see where that goes in the next couple of years as I work on pitching actual, you know, longer graphic novel style books to publishers. Because it just takes a long time making comics, and you can't always be a sprinter. It's hard to let go of that work practice. Because again, it's that instant gratification versus systemic structure to build something that is going to nourish you in years to come. And it's just a different timeline. Working in book publishing is like years as opposed to weeks.
Yeah.
And it's hard to make that transition.
Thank you for sharing that, because I think one of the things that I really want to do is illuminate sometimes social media can give an impression that when you're further in your career, things can be easy or appear easy, but we're all struggling with things
just in
our own way, you know? So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, these are super good questions. I'm very curious to hear what other people on the podcast have to say about them.
One of the things that I often think about is this idea of learning new things. And because as a business owner, you want to be known for something and to be really good at something. But at a certain point, you have to be learning new things.
Yes.
And going out in new directions and, you know, swinging from tree to tree like a lumberjack. So how do you approach learning new things?
Sometimes it is a distraction. I mean, I'm thinking about that. I guess the thing that is foremost on my mind right now is learning Airtable. And I'm like looking at this tab in the background being like, oh, look, my database is there. Maybe I can go play with it afterwards. And there, I do love problem solving. I was just teaching at this place called the Animation Workshop in Denmark, which has it's a established animation school, but they recently launched a graphic storytelling major. So they've been working through their first couple classes of GS students and running them through a 4-year undergraduate program, which is really fantastic. The structure of the school is very clever. They bring in full-time teachers for a week to 3 weeks at a time. And so it's one professor, one working professional who comes and teaches a class on writing for comics or, you know, storyboarding or character design or interactive comics or social media and crowdfunding. And that one teacher is just with the kids full time that whole stretch of time. And then they go off back to their freelance life. And it means that the teaching body is very diverse. You get many, many professors over the course of a semester or a year, but also you have a higher chance of getting people who are active in the field right now, which I think is a common complaint of art school, is that you often get professors who have been out of the workforce, at least in the workforce that those students would be entering, for quite some time. And so they're saying like, oh, it's easy. You become a working fine artist and you get tenure track at college and then you become a professor and like, that's the end of the thing. And you're like, yeah, but I'm graduating into like gig economy central and it's hell out there. Like, how do I survive? And so I think the Animation Workshop has done a really good job of assembling a program that creates more space for that. Anyway, I really loved being there because there were opportunities to see people learning new things. You know, people are there to learn. And I, again, wanting people who are experts, you know, being hungry for proficiency that I can dedicate myself to and learn from. I think what I want a lot of the time is the time and space to learn new things from people who really know what they're about, as opposed to the way that I often end up learning new things, which is frantically by the seat of my pants, only noticing after I've done something that it was mildly successful and that maybe that had something to do with the thing that I did, and then trying to like reverse engineer success. And so much of being a freelancer is just scrabbling to keep your head above water and not having room for the top down visualization of, oh, let me, you know, critical thinking, like analysis. You know, I went to liberal arts school, like this is having the space to look at a passage or a period of time in your life and really break down the component elements to say, what went wrong here? What went right? What could I do better next time? That kind of self-reflection is invaluable, and it's something that I don't feel like I have enough time for. So there are genuinely new things, which I really struggle with. I like being good at things. Driving is a great example. I'm supposed to test for my driver's license at some point. Ever, I guess it would be good before I turn 30 to have a driver's license. But I really don't like practicing driving because I am not good at it yet. I'm not a bad driver. I just like, it is the point in time where it is just a question of brute force practice to get familiar and comfortable with other cars being on the road and operating a motor vehicle around them. And that's just takes, it just takes time. Yeah. And I really struggle to walk into those scenarios where I am not good at something. I know it is good for me. Sometimes it's very fun. Sometimes if I'm going to a figure drawing session and I want to go and like stretch my artistic muscles and try something new, that's fine. Driving is not one of those things. So
I wouldn't want to learn how to drive in Portland either.
No, it's not. Yeah. I mean, like had I already learned to drive in Southern California, you know, small town, not a lot of cars, could have taken my driver's test down there. Would have been great. But alas, no. But it's not just like, I don't just want the license, right? I do want the proficiency of being able to operate a motor vehicle because I go on book tour and it would be great to be able to drive myself places rather than have to take the bus all the time. Or I don't know. It's just options, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess the answer is either I run into it with open arms and I have a wonderful time learning new things, or I grit my teeth and hate it and choose to focus instead on things that I know I'm already kind of good at, which is the coward's way.
You mentioned earlier that you are a bookworm. So what's if you were to distill one book or resource that has impacted your life the most, what would it be?
Oh, the most. Oh, that's hard. If you had said recently, I just
make it recently.
Okay. I mean, there's a couple books that I would definitely point to as like, yes, this changed my life. Yeah. The Creative Habit by Twyla Tharp was a really impactful read for me. I read it when I was in college, and Twyla Tharp is a choreographer, but she writes so beautifully about the fact that creativity is this sort of muscle that you train just like the muscles of your body. And it is something that is made up of a thousand tiny rituals and habits that all just cascade into one another. And she writes really wonderfully about it. And I think about that book all the time. I haven't read it in, you know, probably 6 years, 7 years, but I think about it constantly. And the book that I just read that I think is something I've been hungering for a long time, was called Scratch. It's a collection of essays by edited by Manjula Martin, who ran a blog called Who Pays Writers for a long time. And she has assembled this really stellar lineup of, I mean, big, you know, heavy hitter folks, Roxane Gay, Austin Kleon. Who else is in there? I'm trying to visualize the cover of the book. Jonathan Franzen is in there, I think. Leslie Jameson, Cheryl Strayed. Anyway, there's a bunch of folks in there. It's a really wide range of authors from a staggering variety of disciplines, or, you know, fields, genres. And it's essays and interviews about writing and money and making a living and success and craft. And it is geared towards writers, but honestly, I think it's valuable for any creative professional. In the last 3 years, I have become a really big advocate for financial transparency and discussing the nuts and bolts of how it works to make a living doing this thing, because it's something that I really missed seeing as I was coming up in the scene, was like, I didn't understand money.
Yeah.
In general, I was really frustrated by the opacity of what was going on, that I would ask, you know, people would say like, oh yeah, you know, I got a book deal and I got a really decent advance. And I'm like, what does that mean? What a decent advance is, or people say, I got a decent day rate, or like, what's a standard day rate? And you can look at the Graphic Artists Guild Ethical Pricing Guidelines Handbook, but the numbers in there are prescriptive. They're kind of like, this is what you should be paid. And that's really different from what people actually are paid.
Yes.
And I think if we talk more about what we are paid and what we should be paid, and just the range, you know, it's, I think everyone's always worried about judgment, but like, that is a, we impose that judgment, you know, and if we choose to say, I am gathering information right now, like your success does not preclude my ability to have success. Share how you are doing. And the best case scenario, you know, when I talk to friends who are doing really well in their creative freelancing businesses, it doesn't make me feel like, oh, well, I guess that means I'm never going to make that money because this person has stolen it all.
Right.
I feel like, oh, this is what's possible. You know, you're expanding your horizons, your understanding of how it actually works. And if you tell somebody, I gave a talk 2 years ago at a conference called XOXO about having my first book come out and acquiring an agent and running a really successful Kickstarter campaign and having the best year of my life, scare quotes, while being on food stamps and like really struggling to make ends meet and feeling like there was this invisible barrier that had gone up where people thought I was successful. And because I was successful, they assumed I must be fine financially. And so all of these accomplishments of like getting an agent, having a book come out, going on book tour, were things that I had constructed, that I had worked for. And the real accomplishment of that year was like, I finally got off food stamps, but I didn't know how to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because I had a lot of shame about being on government assistance, but because other people had built this thing that kind of, this plexiglass barrier that built up between me and them. So from that point forward, I felt like it's something that I really missed was candid conversations between creators about how this works on a nuts and bolts level. Because if I had known that it's totally normal to be living at or below the poverty line for the first 4 years of your career as a freelancer, and that, you know, normal for some people, right? Not for others. Some people may make it straight off the bat. Some people may get a day job. All of that is fine.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear more of that. And Scratch is a book that's all about that. So I would heartily recommend that for people who are hungry for more candid discussion from a wide variety of perspectives about where that comes into play and what money looks like for creators and the different ways that we all feel about it.
What's interesting too is like, as you were describing that, I was thinking about income inequality, and often the conversation around that is the difference between the everyday worker and the CEO and how it's astronomically different. But it's like, if you really want to have a conversation about income inequality, we can talk about the closer gaps between one another and actually do something about that, because that seems more attainable than trying to tackle, you know, the gap between CEO and everyone else.
Yes, totally. And that's the difference between, you know, talking to a friend and having them say, like, you're charging $25 an hour. You could totally pay more there. You could charge more than that. You've been freelancing for 6 years. You know, you have a really developed portfolio. I charge $80. You should be charging at least $60. Mm-hmm. Like, we can bring each other to an equitable standard. And it's just hard because there's no union. There's no, you know, standardization. In comics, a lot of the time, you're not getting an hourly wage. You're getting a page rate, which if you work it out to the hourly is always catastrophically depressing. Never do that.
Never.
Yeah, just don't work for page rates or like do, but then have a good side hustle that pays the rest of your bills. I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard to make a living in comics. So I think that's the other reason that I'm obsessed about this stuff is that I've seen people working themselves to death in that grindstone, and I don't want that. I do want something that's sustainable, and I want to find out what it takes to make that happen. So I think that's why I'm really obsessed with pulling from these other arenas, you know, the learning from people who work in business, but learning from people who are doing financial coaching, learning from people who are working even as designers or illustrators instead of cartoonists. We have so much to teach each other. And even if that's just, hey, this is what's possible for a CEO, I'm not a company, or I mean, I am a company, I guess, but I'm the CEO and also the grunt. So how do I build something that feels sustainable and does take advantage of some of those benefits?
Well, Lucy, I just have one more question for you. This has been a fantastic interview. But the question I have for you is, what's one thing in the future you are actively working to make happen?
Got to say this on the air so that I commit to doing it. I am putting together a draft of a graphic novel that I would like to pitch to publishers for real now that I have an agent. He's obviously a little bit confused that I keep self-funding projects through Kickstarter and doing these books entirely independently, that he's like, wait, but where is the thing that I can sell to somebody? You just keep making things and funding them on Kickstarter and like not giving me an opportunity to do my job, which is true. And I, again, this is that thing about learning new things. I am totally terrified. And I've also said this on podcasts before. And so now I'm like, oh God, you said this in an interview like 8 months ago that you were working on this book. How much farther along is it? Not very. So I don't know, new year, new you, right? I am working hard to, or hardly working, to make this book happen. I would really like to try something new as much as I'm dragging my feet about it because it's different and scary. But I think this conversation has been really inspiring for that. You were reminding me that a lot of this practice is about doing things that you are not as comfortable with. So yeah, that's the next thing that I'm working to make happen, I think, is dabbling my toes into the world of writing a book pitch or a script for a graphic novel and then putting it to a publisher and then having them pay for it rather than like 1,000 strangers on the internet, which is weird to me. So we'll see how that goes. But that is my next big creative project.
Well, Lucy, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been a pleasure to spend some time with you and hear all about your adventures internally, externally, on ship, by sea, by land. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, that does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. It's so great to be back. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me that you're here. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and perhaps people who need more adventure in their lives? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and now Spotify. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm Chris at chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter. I'm at CM Studios. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.